Be good.
Hello there. This is the Monkey Tooth Podcast. I'm Andrew, and you are my cherished listener. You're someone who I like and care about, and whose taste in entertainment is clearly great. Welcome to the program. I got a guest for you today. His name is Cody Orell. Most people know him as Cody the Roadie, because obviously it sounds great, and he is in fact a roadie. I met him 5 years ago in Bombay Beach, California. He is yet another of the guests that I met there. I was so fortunate to be around such cool and creative and fun people. But the time I got to spend with Cody was particularly cool because he was real busy. Didn't have a whole lot of time to hang out. He's got another property in town that he was working on. And he's just a hip, busy, popular dude that a lot of people want to talk to. And he was kind enough to sit and talk with me about music, about his life as a facilitator of musical projects, a repair guy, a very smart, very sensitive and creative person that I'm very pleased to be able to share with you, as I mentioned, my cherished listener. So yeah, there's not a whole lot that I want to go over before I get to this episode. I just want to tell you I will be traveling very soon. I'm going to drive from my home in Northern California to New York City. And I'm going to be just me and Pele for about a week driving out there. I'm going to be needing some places to stay if you're on that route. I'm going to take kind of the northerly-ish route. I think that's Freeway 80. And yeah, if you're on my route and want to say hi or hang out or let me take a shower at your house, I'll make it worth your while. I'll tell you a crazy story. I'll give you a free copy of The Moron at the end of this book. That's about all I have to offer, other than you can like play fetch with my dog, which is splendid. But yeah, I'm doing that the first week in May. I'll be leaving maybe the 6th or 7th of May. And then Tiffany and I, my wife, will be driving all over New England, New York, that whole East Coast super hip area. And then we're going to head back to our neck of the woods. We'll be out and about for about a month. So if you think you might be on any of our Eastern, northerly, westerly routes, let me know. Send me a note, mtp.dog/contact. That's mtp.dog/contact, and let me know. Okay, hope all is well with you. Hope you enjoy this episode with my pal, Cody the Roadie. Until next time, adios. Cody, what's your last name?
Orell.
O-R-R-E-L-L. What is that?
I guess it's Irish. It's my dad's adopted father.
Dad's adopted father?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because my dad's father died in World War II.
Oh, wow.
2 weeks after my dad was born.
No shit.
Yeah, and his name was Cotrain. But my grandmother remarried, and that was the Orell name.
Orell. That's what with from. A little...
No, just
an
O-R-R-E-L-L, yeah.
I just found out, like, last year, I had no idea that I was Irish.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you think, like, Irish is like being vegan. Every vegan really wants you to know. Every Irish person really wants you to know. It's like the nationality equivalent. Get that thing, if you don't mind getting it kind of like...
Right up in there. Yeah, okay.
I mean, you can get, you know, cause you got a nice voice, man. I want to hear that thing.
All right.
Nice.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, you're sounding good. Cheers, man. Thank you.
Cheers, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Happy
Tuesday. Yeah, thanks
Tuesday.
For having me.
Happy being
on. Is it
Ollie.
Tuesday? Oh, man.
Yeah. It's a countdown till day zero. So you and I met 5 years ago. I don't know if, did you stick around for the Biennale? Did you come back?
I didn't. I was here... Yeah, I had a break on tour, and I'd met Tao earlier that year, and he had been telling me about it, and I had a break, and I'm like, well, Tao, I'm gonna come out. He's like, well, come to Bombay, check this out.
He's like the consummate. It's not like a promoter energy. It's just this enthusiast energy. Like if you knew a super articulate child who could do stuff, You know, like that right, energy. Right. It's like it's this pure, unadulterated enthusiasm for the project at hand.
It's a catchy sort of passion.
It really is, man. Yeah. I watch him. I've been kind of not spying on him, but like, you know, just watching how he interacts with people. You know, just to learn a little something. You know, about how to be more.
Yeah, I know what you mean. That thing of like the those. I have another friend, Doug, who started a similar thing in LA, and he's just so good with people, you know. Yeah. He's just got that thing. Yeah.
It's a childlike quality, because any adult trying to do it as like a smooth person, it just feels salesy, like they're trying to convince you of something.
Right, right. I think that's a real gift. It's a nuance, man, to be able to not come off as swarmy.
Yeah, no shit, man. Yeah. I like, my voice sounds like I'm trying to sell something. Like, I just have that, and it's sad because I went to school for voiceover to try to learn how to do that craft, and I can't sell shit. Like, I can't make myself get into that. I can't act is the bottom line of it. But my voice perfectly lends itself to being that fucking guy.
Yeah, you got a great voice.
I can't do it. I really have to. I can't find that that center where you just can forget about yourself and just become that character. I don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Your character, you're Cody the Roadie. Like, how long have you been Cody the Roadie?
When did that name, I guess that name popped up probably, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. But I've been doing this, I've been a roadie for bands since, 2002, 2003, somewhere in there. Yeah, started doing that.
Yeah, that's a career, man.
It's a career. Yeah, yeah. I went from dropping out of high school and not knowing what the fuck I was going to do and dabbling in things. And then I just, pretty early on in retrospect, you know, I felt like I was wandering for a while, but 21, I kind of found my thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. I mean, I found my wife at 21. That's about the only thing I did. It's like unequivocally, okay, that was a good choice. I found my wife. That sounds kind of, you know how I mean that. I don't mean like, that's some chauvinist.
How long were you missing her?
Yeah. Where'd you put her, dummy? Yeah. Did you come at it as a musician, or because you're a player, man? Like, I've heard you play. You're quite good.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Grew up, my dad was a musician. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a whole group of stories in itself you know, he kind of was like the Forrest Gump of rock and roll, you know, like backstage at Woodstock you know, and would end up, I mean, he was living next door to Joni Mitchell and Frank Zappa and recording at the studio where Charles Manson was recording friends with the Beach Boys. He was open for the Beach Boys and nice. Yeah, whole bunch of, so I grew up with just music.
You have siblings?
Three sisters.
They all play?
None of them do.
No.
I'm the only one.
I got four sisters and they all play something. I'm the least talented musician in my family. Yeah. Everybody else is fucking awesome.
If my sisters had taken up music too, I would have gotten a little more competitive with it or something.
Yeah, yeah. It was just you and your old man. Would you play together? Did he show you stuff?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we didn't really play together too much until later, and we haven't really played out together. I don't play out very often. Yeah. I just kind of, you know, just like playing music. And he's self-taught too, so, you know, and we both have a very similar kind of ADD brain, so it's like he'd teach me stuff, but it was also like
he's fooling around, fiddling. That's a cool kind of learning, man.
It's cool. Yeah,
I think there's something cool about learning from someone who taught themselves, because they're learning and teaching you.
Right.
It's a hip loop. Have you taught anybody how to play?
A little bit, but you know, I think I have that idea that because I'm self-taught that it's like, you know.
Yeah, you know. I don't know, man. I'm also kind of self-taught. And I've shown people rudimentary stuff, and then like,
right.
you know, a few years later, they can play. I'm like, oh shit, nice. Yeah. You know,
I suppose that. Yeah, I've experienced that too. Yeah,
yeah. It's not like I gave them some brilliant instruction. We're like, okay, if this guy can, you know,
yeah,
it's like I've just lowered their bar. Like, okay, there's my. So you're an East Coast guy.
Originally, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Little town, New Hope, Pennsylvania, just okay. north of Philly.
Nice.
Cool town. You know, growing up, you don't appreciate the place you're sure. from, but like, but when I was growing up, it was like this little arts colony, it kind of equidistant from New York and Philadelphia.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, cool. So it's great yeah. for that. An hour to each city. You're great. And then when I was growing up in the 80s, it was a big town for the pagan bike gang.
Oh, yeah.
So like it would be like you'd be waiting to turn right on the road at the end of my street, you know, and it would be like 15 minutes of bikes going Whoa. By when I was a kid. And then it was also the second highest, I think this is right, the second highest per capita gay town in America at the
really?
Time. So it was like
New Hope.
Yeah, New Hope. Yeah.
Wow,
so so growing up, and it's like I've thought about this later, and it's really funny, like my parents' friends and like my early like ideas of like who cool adults were like drag queens and bikers, you nice. Know.
Oh my god, that's what a cool mix.
Yeah, it's something, you know, and it's like, you know, childhood, you have nothing to reference,
right?
So it's all normal.
Just normal, but yeah, yeah, yeah. That's wild. Were you a traveling family? Did you guys do
no,
a lot of that?
No, almost no traveling.
And your dad had stopped playing music professionally when by the time
yeah,
you came
I mean,
around?
he. So when I was a kid, he was playing guitar in gospel bands.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I got some exposure for being, you know, New Hope being suburbia that it is pretty white area, but we're really close to Trenton, New Jersey, which yeah. is almost entirely like black, you know, and it's yeah, like, yeah. and it's weird. You really have a strong divide around there, but
yeah, yeah.
so it was cool having that exposure as a kid too. And like, yeah. you know, it's like, yeah, between the drag queens and the bikers and the big black gospel ladies, it
yeah,
was like,
I love like gospel music instrumentation.
Oh
and
my
like,
God.
The rhythms and the melodies are so fucking cool to me, man.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just like, I mean, it's all of soul and R&B. It's all like a derivative
all,
thing.
Yeah, and it all comes, I mean, and you hear in so much modern music and in pop music,
right,
it's like there's, it's dumbed down, but it's like a lot of it is getting its roots from
still
gospel and those chord progressions and yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Like musicology nerds, they'll start, you know, running down like the African roots of it and how it, like even the Appalachian roots somehow mm-hmm. got this
yeah.
weird. There's such an interesting musical heritage on the East Coast of this country.
Yeah,
that is so deep. And it's all like tied to rivers and fucked up towns. And,
yeah.
You know, there's like this just, I don't know, there's, it's like endlessly explorable, you know?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and it makes sense that like, you know, you had the Mississippi, you know, at the end of this giant trade river, you have all this music coming together, you
totally.
Know? It's like, of course.
Yeah, yeah. From New Orleans up, man.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
oh, man.
So yeah. much variety and so much like, I don't know, like storytelling. It was a very like yeah. story heavy kind of music.
Totally.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to, I feel really fortunate to have grown up and just with an American musical tradition. You know, it's like we don't really think of us having a musical tradition in this country, but we have a,
God.
It's so deep. It's like,
well, I mean, you've toured in Europe.
Yeah.
yeah. Their appreciation of our music is outrageous.
Oh, it's like, yeah, yeah, totally. Like,
I mean, I haven't been back to Europe in over 20 years now, but like, you know, I'd met some guys who are touring the US, you know, like this kind of crazy British guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they came over to my house like, oh my God, you got a fucking Peavey? You got a Peavey amp? You know, like those Mississippi,
right,
like
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
just nasty blues amp. And they're like, oh my God. And they were just nerding out over the gear that we could get here.
Right.
You know, they
right.
were, it was like story weird shit over there, like exotic.
Right, yeah. right. And so that is always so funny. It's like, because
yeah.
I'm everywhere I go, I'm always looking for gear. It's like what I do on my days off. And,
yeah.
and it is like people's perception of, and,
right.
it's, and you realize it's like so many things like that.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I first went to Europe, all my friends and I had like European cars. We were into European cars or Japanese cars, and there they all wanted American cars.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh wow, yeah, that's
yeah. It's fun. That you yeah. know that other. The, I don't know if it's a grass is greener thing, but I mean, yeah, the Beatles, for God's sake, man, talk about just yeah. you know Americana music files. You know, they're like between Elvis and Little Richard.
Yeah.
And stuff.
I mean, Little Richard,
dude. Yeah. I know, what a wild person. Yeah, I grew up in Memphis. I was born in Memphis, kind of grew up in Memphis and Mississippi. And that music, like, still, you know, it just imprints on you in a way that, like, you hear it and you just you can't help but just feel like, God, you know, just like something grabs you.
Yeah, there's a great phrase about, like, you call it gut bucket.
The gut bucket.
Yeah. Gut bucket.
And the bucket of blood. Yeah.
Gut bucket blues. Yeah. Like, that's like, that's it.
Yeah. There's, and that, you know, where I came from, like North Mississippi, like the Burnsides and like Earl Burnside and all those guys, like that, there's like the hill country. And then there was like, you know, that was electric kind of driving stuff. But then there was that killer, like older country blues that like, you know, John Lee Hooker down in Clarksdale.
Sure.
Playing that like before they got electric, you know, and just playing that killer old acoustic stuff.
Yeah. Man.
It's just that to me is like the most, when you hear like Senegalese music or music from Mali.
Right. Oh man. Yeah.
It's in there.
100%. 100%. Growing up, my dad listened to a lot of African music.
Oh, cool.
And then a lot of blues. I had a really good musical education through him, and you know, and
that's
so
cool.
Yeah, some of these guys from Mali, Salif Keita, Almal. I mean, some of these, specifically Mali too, really
Mali,
puts out these amazing musicians. Totally. You know, of course, Alifaka Touré, and Senegal too. Yeah, it's the Senegalese rhythms are really really deep. Yeah.
Now there's this stuff coming out of like Lagos that sounds like reggaeton.
Yeah, I've heard some of that. Yeah.
I don't want no other body. And it's like this like highly slick, cool shit. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Where's this coming from? You know, they just like took reggaeton and made it African in a different way.
I mean, you always have that. There's always this really cool thing when you see, because so much music has come out of Africa, and then when it comes back, it's super cool.
It's
you get a really cool thing. Yeah,
yeah. To take like African stuff that turned into pop and then turn it back into African pop is like, what?
Yeah, like some of the African reggae that started happening in the late 70s. Alpha Blondy and those guys, super cool. Yeah.
There's something about like one of the few things I really, really like YouTube for, other than like learning how to do a thing, you know, like people keep unearthing. I don't even know how it's still possible. How much music was made in the 70s that just got any airtime, but there's still these records out there. Like, I've heard like Turkish psychedelia and you know Japanese surf rock. It's like what? All this stuff keeps surfacing. I'm like, man, it's just an endless.
Yeah, it's incredible. I love world music, and but like when you start digging in, you're like, oh, well, this is infinite. Like there's,
bottom.
I mean, and so much of it's just such great music too. Yeah. The Ethiopian stuff, the 60s and 70s, and
oh yeah, the Ethiopiques, man.
Oh my god,
that stuff. When I first heard that Ethiopiques record, I was like, what? How did this? How is this not the most popular shit?
I know.
ever. Like, when did they record this? Like,
I know. That's the thing. Is this stuff was like, but it was them listening to the jazz of the day and interpreting it and blending it with like, I mean, Ethiopian traditional music is super cool. Anyway, super, it's so spooky.
Yeah.
You know, it's
got that little finger guitar thing. That nut. What do they call that?
Like a kalimba.
Kalimba. Yeah. Those are badass. And they got them like with the little vibe. You can like make it vibraphone like with your fingers or like put little holes inside.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, dude.
Yeah. Killer. the first time I heard that record, I was like, wait, is it possible that Jimi Hendrix heard this? Because some of the production value on that, like that, that weird ethereal stuff. It's like, oh my God, it sounds like Axis Bold is love or something. It was like really trippy to me. Anyway, sorry to dork out on the psychology. we were talking about your touring, man. Have you been to Africa?
I've toured just in East Africa. I've been to Ethiopia and Egypt.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. How was that?
I mean, both of us were wild. Egypt.
Wait, who are you touring with?
That was with Beyonce.
No shit.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Is she just worshipped over there? Are they crazy about her?
Ethiopia was cool because they go by a different calendar than us. So in 2007, they're on the Julian calendar. Are we on the Julian calendar?
I don't know.
I'm too dumb. Either we're on the Julian or
yeah.
But one it's seven, is yeah, it 7 years difference. So 2007 was their millennium.
Oh, wow.
So Ethiopia was over there by themselves having a millennium party in 2007. And they built this big building, and this dude brought in all these artists and like, it was totally extravagant. I come to learn later that he's like, and this is kind of typical for a lot of these gigs, it's like, oh, he was like the biggest gun runner in Africa.
Monster.
Yeah,
this dude, Alamudi.
Alamudi? Alamudi, yeah. But Ethiopia was amazing. I had a great time. Yeah.
I love Ethiopia. The food, man.
Oh my God, the food and the coffee there. It's the home of coffee.
It's the home of coffee.
And
do Ethiopians do the thing with the cardamom in it, or is that just the Turkish?
No, they do straight coffee.
Yeah.
That's awesome. There's almost like a Japanese tea ceremony. They have a coffee ceremony.
Really?
Yeah, pretty cool.
That's cool. How long were you there?
Probably about a week, if that. You know, 5 days or something.
And
just
roaring. You're working your ass off.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. That particular tour, we ended up with a lot of free time. It's not usually the case, but I think we were going to places that were, you know, where they haven't done shows before, so we really needed to get there with a bunch of time.
Right. To get things
sorted, and not necessarily me, because I take care of instruments.
Nice.
Yeah, so I come in once everything's already set up, but the guys rigging and building the stage,
Jesus,
God bless them.
So explain to me your role, man, because like I always think about that. I got offered a job once with the North Mississippi All Stars.
Oh yeah, great.
And I didn't take the gig, and it was just they're like, we just need you to tune guitars and like change strings and sit. And yeah. I just couldn't believe that that was it.
It's not it.
But like, no, it's no big deal.
That's how they rope you in.
Yeah, just tune up, man. You've got a good ear. Just tune the guitars. Well, look, we got a tuner, man. Just change strings. You can change strings. You know, those would lay it on
there. I mean, it's, and some gigs it can just be that. You know, I've had really easy gigs where, it's one keyboard and that's kind of it, you know. But mostly, yeah, so I take care of keyboards and guitars mainly. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of found myself in this, you know, thing where I'm kind of a vintage keyboards guy. Kind of become, and guitars
like
and stuff.
Rollins and Casios or
like electromechanical. So like Rhodes and Wurlitzers and clavinets. Nice. And then the thing that I find myself doing the most these days is B3 organs.
Yeah. And you're repairing? Can you repair those on site?
Mm-hmm. So there's some stuff you can do on site. A lot of stuff, you know, especially B3. It's like,
I don't even know how they work.
Oh my God. It's like you open it up and it's like this. Yeah. It's like opening the hood of a car. It's wild, yeah.
But you don't have to deal with amps. You're not.
I do have to deal with amps. Okay. Yeah. There's amps involved in those, and then I also do guitars, so right. I deal with amps too.
So you're dealing with the instrument and the amp. I see.
Yeah.
So I've always wondered about those like those crazy Leslie speakers.
That's I have to work on Leslie's a lot. Yeah.
That just seems like a labor intensive thing to me because there's so many things that can go wrong function.
I mean, when you think about, you know, the Leslie I just had out on tour, I think was from the 70s. So it's 50 years of moving parts.
Yeah.
That need to keep. So
nice service.
Yeah. Constantly adjusting.
We explain to people what a Leslie
is. Right. So Leslie speaker is, it goes with a B3 organ, which is like the standard organ that you hear on all the gospel
Ray
stuff.
Charles.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. That's all, you know, think of Al Green. That's yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And the speaker goes with it, even though the companies hate each other.
Really?
Yeah, the companies don't like each other. There's a whole rivalry there.
That's funny.
But what it is there's two speakers, a high and a low one, and you have a switch on the organ, and you switch it, and the speakers are spinning slow, and you switch it, and they go faster. And
so is the
and
actual speaker
slow.
Itself that's spinning? Or is it like a thing around it?
Yeah, it's a baffle. Yeah. So there's one speaker facing up that goes through two spinning horns, and then one facing down, and there's kind of like a drum with an angle piece in it that kind of pushes it out. Yeah.
It's such a cool, like, do you know the history behind that? Like, who came up with that? Was it just a dude named Leslie?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all too easy.
I've read a little bit about it. I can't remember the details, but I just remember that there was a whole thing where Hammond didn't like that he was making speakers for their organ, so they kept changing the connector and changing all the things around to make it hard for him.
It just, like, it's one of those things where you know there was a point where that sound didn't exist, right? No one had heard that on purpose anyway.
Right.
You know, it's like
right.
a story of distortion. Like, there was an accident. Something fell off a truck. And it fell off a truck. And then it was like, oh, my God, that sound is killer.
I mean, the thing is, it's like back then you had so many things that were novel. You know, like the sound of a flanger was, you know, I'd have to verify this, but I've heard it was John Lennon rubbing his finger against a tape reel and taking it slightly out of time and then taking it off. And,
oh, wow. And to phase it. And
yeah.
Make it
yeah. To get this flange thing.
Yeah. Wow.
And it was because he was rubbing the flange of the.
Right. Oh, that's why I got it named.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I just like the Leslie thing in particular, like, who heard, how do you, like, I can understand finding distortion, right? I mean, that's just an overblown, but like that whirling and the spinning of an amp, like what?
Yeah, you had to have that idea and do a lot of engineering before you ever heard it.
Before you ever really heard it and to see if it works.
You're just really thinking like, this is, I'm betting this is going to be cool.
Because like, were people playing those, like, no one was just holding notes like that.
I mean,
like in classical music, you could get vibrato from like a
That's the thing is so when the organ, the organ was revolutionary. That was
unbelievable.
They were calling it electronic music.
Yeah,
which now we think of it and it's funny, but organ music was electronic music, and it was in New York the first what's called a tone wheel organ, which is essentially an organ that can generate a tone forever. You know?
Yeah.
But it was massive, and it was built into the basement, of this building near Radio City. And,
it's a massive bus coming in.
Oh yeah.
It's like a school bus, like a schoolie.
Oh yeah.
Sweet. Sorry.
Yeah. The parade of vehicles.
Yeah. Here we go. Yeah. Bombay Beach, baby. There's a full house air conditioner on the top of that son of a bitch. Oh my God.
they need a better turning radius. Come
That's
on.
Amazing. Oh God.
So the first tone wheel, and it was these giant massive wheels. And the way it works is that there's a steel wheel and you cut all these notches in it equidistant apart, and they spin and they go past a little magnet. And it just, however many times they go past per second is their frequency. And so all you're doing is you're just essentially just, you know, opening up those, when you press the key, you're just, those are all going all the time. You just open them up.
What?
You know?
How in the hell did people figure this out?
And I love these kind of things that are musical inventions, because you can understand someone like, you know, like inventing something to make money or whatever.
Or to save lives. Whatever.
But to go through all this effort just to like, ooh, that's a new sound.
Well, I heard the same thing about like, what's the dude from The Police? Shit.
Guitar player. Stuart Copeland's. Andy Summers.
That he was like pals with somebody at NASA. in the, like their radio, whatever. And that's how he had all those weird effects.
Oh, get out.
That he was developing effects for Andy.
Wow.
You know, just based on his, you know, knowledge of transmitting data, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, and once you get into it, it's like, you know, the all these things apply. You know, you right. can see a cool phenomena happening in electronics and be like, ooh,
what if I apply it?
What
it
does
here?
It sound like?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? What happens if I feed it a tone?
Right.
And then what does it do to that tone?
Yeah. Know? Yeah, that's such a weird thing, man. Like I saw, was it Paul Stamets trying to get the electromagnetic frequency of mushrooms to play that sound, you know? And they make tones. Like, I mean, you could put it up against a growing tomato and it's emitting
some sort of frequency.
Yeah. Like, and I think that's part of how bees are navigating.
Yeah.
They're changing the positive to negative or whatever, the charge of any given thing.
Right, right.
To let you know, I already hit that. I hit that flower. You don't need it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But all that would, if you could translate it, make a sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
Turn anything into a tone.
Yeah, it's all nuts. You know, I mean, it's all electronic impulses and electronic signals. And I did a cool project with a buddy of mine. It was mostly his thing, and he went and displayed it. But we worked on it together when the Beckley Foundation did the you've probably seen them, the functional MRIs of people on LSD.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were able to get the MRI data from that. And we took it, and by changing the time scale of it, like if we speed it up, all of a sudden it's audible, And we fed it into synthesizers and things and into tone generators, and used some parts for modulation. It's like, you know, essentially it's a frequency on a graph. So, okay, well, you know, chop it up, compress it, do all sorts of things with it. And
that's
you
wild.
Can, yeah, I mean, you know. Made this musical piece. I mean, it was really him. I just was helping out.
Yeah, but I mean,
it was cool to like get cool all that data and be able to play with it and
can
stuff.
Can you hear that? Is it available to listen to? Is it
out there? I could reach out to him. Yeah, it was just performed once at the Royal College of London.
All that work. Yeah. That's amazing. I love it when someone does some shit like that. You know, they put in all this monumental effort and they show it one time. Yeah, that's.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
That's killer. That's so killer. I've got this weird. Maybe see what you think about it, man. This is like some goofball out there shit, but I just feel like the microbes in our guts, like there's just like this whole colony of beings that is in us, that's most of us, right? I mean, that has this inordinate presence in our body.
Right.
I just feel like music is how they communicate with each other. Like the ones that live in me communicate with Beyonce. Or Beyonce communicates with, you know what I mean? Like, and they're feeding us ideas because, you know, they're linking the gut to like your mood.
Yeah, totally.
How well you learn.
Yeah.
If you're going to have Alzheimer's. I mean, like,
no,
all
we
these,
have an intelligence there for sure.
Right.
Yeah,
there's something else going on. And music is that one thing that, like, it can translate. Like, I always use the example of like the first time I really heard music, I was very small and my mom played piano and organ in the Catholic Church.
Oh, great.
And it was this immediate dour, sad shit. But I had no cultural reference for why that would be sad, right? I didn't know shit about why people would be sad for anything. I didn't know what anxiety was. I didn't know.
Right,
know, like,
right,
guilt.
Exactly, yeah.
but that sound immediately struck me as sad. And I felt it. I mean, I could feel the sadness in my body in a bodily way. Mm. It's like, wait, why is that? You know, and that's not.
Yeah, because we don't have to make music.
No.
Humans don't have to make. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not something we have to do.
Yeah, it's not like a bird call. You know.
Yeah.
A bird call is not even music. You know, we think of it as music because it sounds
pretty.
I mean,
and that's the thing is that's, you know, that's probably pretty akin to where our musical proclivities come from. Is that like
animal sounds?
Animal sounds. And a bird calls are, you know, for warnings and for mating.
Yeah.
You know.
And why does that, like a bird call that could mean one thing to birds that may, to us, sounds happy. Like, oh, what a happy bird. It's like that thing is fighting for its fucking life.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's whatever. It's like.
There's a great guy, John Young, who's a wilderness survival expert in Washington. And he is a, you know, a master of bird calls.
Oh, wow.
And he can tell you what everyone...
That's a crested warbler of the...
And which of their five calls they're doing, know, and what it means.
Yeah.
And so he's like... He's one of those guys who can be in the woods and just listen to the birds and know what's happening 10 miles around
him.
Wild. Yeah.
That's such an amazing thing, man. We've really... There's so much to know.
Mm.
It's just an endless amount of
shit. Lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes.
Yeah. It's every time I think about like how much I don't know, I'm like, why did I watch that video?
Yeah.
Why did I look at Instagram for that long? What am I doing?
I know, right? I know.
What am I doing? I have like all of human knowledge in a little brick in my pocket. And I'm like, what was happening?
I'm like, I want to watch people. Like, I want to watch somebody do some dumb prank or something. I don't know.
I watched somebody's dog eat a taco. You know, yeah. Yeah, it's strange, man. It's a strange thing.
But that is part of all human knowledge is like, you know, seeing that dog eat a taco.
Yeah. Oh man, sorry. I keep getting distracted from your
tangents.
Yeah. I am very genuinely curious about your job and what you do.
Yeah,
and you've worked. Did you start with like rock bands or just did it?
So I started. There was a guy Ralph Smith who, rest in peace, great guy, wonderful guy. He used to work for a lot of bands in back in the day. And he connected me with a company that rented out music instruments. And so I started with them and did that for like 2 or 3 years.
They call it Frontline Equipment? Or is that
Backline?
Backline.
Backline, yeah.
Somewhere in the
line. Yeah, exactly, okay. Yeah.
Backline. Backline Equipment.
Yeah. So it was a Backline rental house. And they would rent, you know, I started off just driving the truck for the first year and, you know, which was great because it got me driving big vehicles in New York and
it's no joke.
Yeah, I learned quick.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever knock in anything?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll come back. I'll circle back to that.
Nothing major, but I've had plenty of like...
Missing side mirrors and
shit. I went over the roof of over the hood of a cab one time, but it was totally his fault. I was pulled him in front of my wheel. I don't know.
Are there cabs still? Are they okay? Like... I haven't been to New York
They're still there. They're still there.
Because I had a particularly adversarial relationship with cab drivers. I was a delivery driver.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, same thing. It's like you hate them. Yeah,
it was so gross, man.
Yeah,
I was like, why do I feel this way?
The worst are the black ones. Black cars, because they're super entitled. Yeah.
Yes. And like the craziest ones are the car service dudes from like Brooklyn and Queens.
Yeah. I still get calls from them. That's so funny.
They're the best.
But so anyway, so I started working for them and did that for a couple of years and that's when I really got into keyboards and the old electromechanical stuff.
A mentor, a guy showing you what to do.
Yeah, yes and no. You know, it was kind of like... And this was pre-YouTube, too, so I was, like, figuring it out.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, I'm like, oh, my God, I had no idea what I was doing. But at the time, I taught myself enough to, like, be able to do gigs. And I got into clavinets, and we were doing a bunch of Stevie Wonder stuff.
Wow.
So I ended up on that gig because I knew clavinets and knew the other keyboards. And so Stevie had a guy who was like 75 and had been with him forever.
Yeah.
And we were doing this run of shows, probably like, it was maybe 7 or 8 shows. And early into it, Mick fell and broke his hip. Mick was Stevie's guy.
Yeah.
And I'd been doing the shows, so I was the only one who was there, who knew Stevie's setup. Everything has to be placed very specifically.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So, yeah, I found myself, I was like 23, and I was Stevie Wonder's tech.
What?
And, you know, in retrospect, I'm like, I was so out of my depth, you know?
Yeah.
But also, it was great. Worked. Nothing went wrong, and it was all, and I was actually able to, you know,
you
was able to do
thing.
It. And,
you learned it, yeah.
And I got to have that relationship with one of my idols. Like,
oh,
really?
Man.
I mean, to have that really early on in my career was just like, well, okay, like whatever now. I'm like, this is all icing.
This.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get to witness him multi-instrumental, like play all the other shit?
No. No, I only ever played keyboards. Yeah, I never saw him play drums. I would have loved to have seen him play drums.
Right? A buddy of mine was playing a gig in Chicago, and they were a three-piece. It was keys, you know, organ player singing. My buddy was on bass and a drummer. And they played like kind of Dr. John style New Orleans type of shit. And they're just, you know, having a great set. Everybody's having a good time. And the club owner was like, hey, Stevie Wonder's in the audience right now. And they're like, what? Like, and he wants to sit in. And so the organ player's like, no problem, man. He can take, I'll just watch. That'd be fucking crazy. Yeah. He's like, he wants to play drums. And he's like, what? So Stevie Wonder comes up.
Dude, he's great.
He comes up on stage and he's like, hey. And like, My friend, the bass player, he's like, man, this is the only time in my career I ever just turned around. I turned my back on the audience and just watched Stevie Wonder play drums. Because he sat down and kind of oriented himself. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, what are we going to play? And then just like, they just tore into some, you know, like crazy New Orleans jazz standard stuff. And he just wore it out. I mean, just like.
He's great, man. He's
such a talented
dude. He's so. And when he plays keys, like he's like he, you can't believe that he's making that sound, because it looks like he's just batting like a cat, like batting at the keys, like, and it's, but you're hearing Superstition come out. It's incredible.
That I mean, Songs in the Key of Life, that Heaven is 10 zillion light years away, that song. Every time I hear that, it makes my spine tingle a little bit.
He's
amazing. That, what a cool experience, man. That's amazing. So that's where you kind of started. When you were like, okay, I've got to.
That was my first. I was still working for the company then, but that was my first like, oh, I'm like teching for someone.
You know,
it was up until that point, it had just been, it was mostly bands that had their own guys. And I would come in and just like, I would interface with the guys and, you know, with their tech, with the band's techs and make sure. And then, you know, and I'd have a handful of experiences like this, but this was like, okay, I'm on this run of shows and I'm Stevie's guy for this run of shows.
Wild.
And then that kind of just led to, I spent a lot of time in the R&B world. I went out with Beyonce probably 5 or 6 tours with her.
Wow.
Yeah.
Getting bigger every time. Like, what period of her career?
We started in arenas. I started on the, the B-Day? The B-Day album, which my little sister thought was Bidet. I think that's great. I did that tour. So I did, 2007, 2009, 2013.
Did you have any kind of relationship with her? Did you like have a...
Early on, you know, it was like, it was always fun, you know, and it was cool. Like, rehearsals with her were really collaborative, which was cool. She's like really into like hearing people's ideas and stuff. And even me, like as the tech, you know, we were usually... Most other acts, you just kind of like stay out of the creative process. But that was always cool that Beyonce, she really did, you know, always wanted people's input.
That's cool.
And like, and would hear it.
Wonder if there's some sort of correlation to like outrageous success and willingness to be open.
I mean, she's a great cultivator of talent and a great collector of talent, you know, really. It's,
I hear her band is like just top notch.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and that was when she first started with the all girl band.
Yeah.
Which was cool. It was like, you know, and it was funny to find myself there, like, you know, but it was kind of right, you know, growing up with all sisters and, you know, and it's like, I had no problem being like, okay, 22 women on stage, like between dancers and band. It's like, okay, fine.
I would feel so much more comfortable with that than like a rocking bunch of dudes, you know? Like,
well, and that was like my first like tour where like I left the company, I went independent and like, and so it was a really nice... And I did, and I worked almost exclusively for like female pop artists for a while. It was like Beyonce, right to Mariah Carey, to Alicia Keys stuff. I'd always kind of done some Alicia Keys here and there, but you know, I did more with her, and I still work with her now. She's great.
Nice.
Demi Lovato. Who else? So I did all these like. really up until 2017. Oh no, I suppose I did work with Foreigner briefly.
Oh,
but that was kind of like the one rock dude band I worked with.
Foreigner, but they must have. I mean, they must have been in their like 60s and 70s.
Yeah, it's well, and it's like it's also like. You know,
this
guy's guy's been in the band for 20 years. This guy's been here for 30 years. This guy's been for 10.
Yeah.
But now I guess Mick, who was the writer of the songs and everything, he's retiring now.
Okay.
And they're up for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. I don't know if that's going to happen. Yeah.
You think you'll work their show?
I used to do that show a lot when I worked for the Backline Company.
Yeah,
so if they do it, I'm going to call them and be like, hey,
yeah, can you get me a little?
I'd like to do this one.
It's, yeah. I live with and work for a guy who was a producer back in from like the '60s into the 2000s.
Oh wow, great!
Yeah, he started with the Love and Spoonful.
Oh, great!
Like was kind of
if you believe in magic.
Yeah,
great one. Yeah.
Working with Mama Cass and all those guys, like you know, and Phil Oakes and like. Then moved to San Francisco and got hooked up with Norman Greenbaum, the Spirit in the Sky.
Yeah.
And like anyway, he had this hell of a career, Chris Isaak. But his whole like his experience with it as a producer, you know, like that behind the scenes dude that no one ever heard of. He actually Phil Spector was quoted once was like, you know, no one knows about the producer. I mean, who's ever heard of Eric Jacobson, which is my friend. Like, he actually called him out by name, you know,
like, as being obscure. As like, and
no one knows who this dude is, but you've heard his music, you know,
right?
Like he kind of created folk rock.
Yeah. Wow.
Cause he was like, he was out one night in the village and he was in a, like he was a banjo player in like a folk group and he'd smoke some pot. It was at a pizzeria. And he put some money in the machine and the Beatles came on. And he heard like this just, you know, that cool arrangement and that depth and all that shit. He was like, I want to do this with folk instruments. But no one's doing this with folk instruments. I want to do it. And that's when he hooked up with like, you know, all these like incredible singers.
Wow.
And, you know, John cool. Sebastian and stuff. But the reason I'm bringing that up is like that collaborative process. You know, like to have any kind of agency over with a creative person when you're not the one creating the thing. Like it wasn't your idea for the
song.
Right. But you've got enough creative cachet where they trust you to have agency over that thing.
Right.
Like
right.
What does that feel like on that level?
Well, yeah, it catches me off guard. You know, I most notably, like for a while, I was working for Justin Timberlake as his tech, you know, and that involved us like before the show, we'd hang out and like do edits on Ableton, like sometimes half an hour before the show, like,
jeez.
And so we'd be doing these things and then like we'd play them live in front of a bunch of people, never having rehearsed them or anything, or you know these. So it's like really nerve wracking. But I found that Justin, we'd be working on something and like, and I'm so used to just like helping someone execute their idea and remove the technical barrier to the creativity. Yeah. But it was like it was really cool with those because it was like. He's like, well, what do you think we should do? Or like, should we do it like this? Or like, we'd have to make little decisions. We would bring in I would find an acapella rap or I'd create an acapella rap out of a track for whatever the big rapper was from the city we were in. And we would live remix it on an MPC.
Oh, no.
It was really cool.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a cool moment. But
yeah.
So we'd have to like pick which ones to use and how to chop up the phrasing and like
and so you got a hand in it. You were like helping create a tune.
Yeah, and it was something where because of the nature of it where we'd always be doing it the last minute, it's like you make decisions and you gotta go with them, you know?
Yeah. So the reason I brought up my buddy the producer, I wanted to kind of draw this thing, like, do you feel ever compelled or qualified or interested in producing music?
I do. I'm, but for me, it's so much more about exploration of technique or sound design or, you know, I'll have about a million 16 bar loops, but nothing that I've like ever, you know, my interest falls off in the large, in, you know, larger scale arrangements or, right, or things like that. My interest is in like creating a groove or, and so, you know, and I do produce some larger scale stuff, out here in Bombay. It's cool. Cause like there's always parties and and it's like I can
just jam.
Jam and play stuff.
But it seems like you've got this, I mean, just from what you've told me about your experience from fucking Stevie Wonder to Justin Timberlake and everything in between.
Like, wild, yeah.
You know, that like, you've got an idea and a very visceral, like, touched it, seen it, been a part of it, taken it apart, put it back together, worldview of the structure of music, instrumentation, things that will work, things that you can see people move more. Right, like you're backstage, you're watching from the side. Do you ever just watch the people dancing?
Yeah, sure, sure. And well, and then not only do you see what makes people move more, but you see what makes people, because you're doing the same show night after night, so you see that moment every night, and you come to expect it. Like, oh, people love this part.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And there was a couple of years ago, I kind of had this realization that all the time I'd spent working with these musical directors, and in these, you know, long rehearsals where we'll be in a rehearsal hall for 6 weeks, you know, long days every day, that I can't help but have been developing my ear for arrangement and for instrumentation and all these things. Yeah. and it's something that I find that now, when working with people or with working with friends and making music and stuff, it's that a lot of stuff is just really clear, you know, to me in that way. Like, oh no, it should go this, or it should be this, or, you know,
there's the resolve. This is the beat to hit.
Right.
But like, you know, my buddy, I mean, he's 84 now, but he was always searching for hits. You know, he was just always swinging for the fences. Everything was like,
I'm so bad at picking hits.
Yeah. But to me, like, I mean, everybody's got to do their own thing. Like, if, you know, my interest in music wouldn't be to be the hit maker.
Right.
You know, it would be just like to make the coolest thing with the most talented people that I could gather, you know, and because like the hits, that's, you just, I don't know what the magic sauce is. Some people have got it worked out and some people don't. And, but just being able to make something that you're proud of and that you love and is like, you know, what you would listen to if you.
Well, and that's how it should be too. Right. You know, it's like when we cater other tastes, it's like, why are you doing art then? Why have an artistic pursuit if it's going to be to cater to other tastes, you know?
Yeah.
It even feels like so many people want success, and but they want it to be able to be free from worry and judgment on the other side, which isn't going to happen.
Yeah, you know? You're never going to clear that hurdle.
Yeah. And it's like, so I can, you know, but it's like, very rarely do you meet someone who is a pop artist who is like, that's what they listen to all the time, and that's what they're super passionate. They're like in tune with what's happening with pop, but it's like at home they're putting on Ella Fitzgerald or something, you know?
Right, right, right. Well, Justin Timberlake strikes me as one of those. He's a Memphis guy.
He's a Memphis guy.
Yeah. I had this weird scene once with Justin Timberlake where I didn't get to meet him, but he was dating Cameron Diaz at the time.
Sure, sure.
And he was getting like a local Grammy, like a Memphis Grammy award. And I went to this dinner and, you know, like
a mammy.
Have a mammy. It was so goofy. But you know, it was a nice honor, and they kept on drawing that Elvis, you know, comparison and stuff. And I was with this my friend who was kind of an older guy, and his sister got extremely drunk. And she was like 70. She was fucked up, man, just pouring back that Chablis. And it was like time to go, man. And my buddy was talking to somebody, and I was like, oh, come on. So I go to his sister Babs, and she's talking to this lady. Old Babs is just wearing this lady out. And I look, and so I'm like, fuck. So I tap the lady on the shoulder, and she turns around, and it's Cameron Diaz, and her eyes are I mean, as big as the dinner rolls that we had for, I mean, just fucking massive. She's like, I was like, I'm so sorry to bother you. I need to talk to Babs. Can I interrupt you? And she's like, what I realized as I touched her on the shoulder, I was like, what is she saying to this lady? She was talking to her as if she was a character in one of her movies. She wasn't talking to Cameron Diaz. She was talking to Mary from All Up or whatever. It was so fucking cringy and weird. And I just
hope Babs.
Yeah. I got this amazing sense of like, thank you from Cameron Diaz. but I got no Justin Timberlake, but his acceptance speech at that thing was kind of hip because he did have like, it wasn't a prepared speech. He just got up and said a thing, you know, and you could tell he knew the music. He knew music in a hip way. At least it seemed like it to me.
No, he's very musical. And I mean, I didn't realize when I first started working for him, I didn't realize he was such a musician, you know. He plays guitar and keyboards.
Yeah.
But then in working with him, it's like there would be like a beat that would come on and be like one day we were doing this acapella rap thing for each city, and we were in Houston, and I was like, oh, you should do that Beyonce song that Beyonce did, this rap. Uh-huh. Beyonce. And he's like, yo, I produced that. And like,
what?
And I had no idea that he produced this song, and it had this really cool drum beat. And he's like, yeah, that was me, sticks on a bucket.
Fuck.
I was like, come on. Fuck, man.
Yeah. 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 But you're right though. It does seem like kind of rare that there's like this, a working knowledge of music in a hit maker. It's not always that.
Yeah.
It's not
always they're kind of different things. It's really like, you know, yeah, and there's a formula that has to be, but it's like that formula is only there because of people that
A&R guys and record companies.
Well, but the formula, you know, it's like it had to come from an original artistic thing.
Yeah,
that someone, you know, this kind of chord change, or even like the first bridge, you know, the first person who put a musical bridge in a song.
Yeah,
it's like it's cliche and formulaic now, but it's like it came from an original
brand new
place. And pretty much everything in music was novel at a time,
of course, yeah.
But it's like boiled down of like, oh, people liked that, people like that, people like that, people like that, and put it together and not care about the overall cohesiveness of
right,
it. It's
right.
Just like this, you know, a patchwork of like,
yeah,
of little neural goodies, you know.
I feel like I've heard some K-pop stuff come on. I'm like, what are you guys doing? What is this crazy thing?
Right. It feels like all these little things where it's like almost like as if someone was like hooked up to a machine and like, oh, the dopamine tick there. Yeah. Well, remember that?
No,
that
totally,
chord, you know?
Totally. It has a very like a researched vibe, or, you know, like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a strange thing, man. But whatever, man, if it makes you, you know.
Yeah.
We're doing that thing.
For any of it. It's all music.
Yeah. Doing that thing that people did to the Hammond, like all this electronic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was symphonies written that people were like, you know, we listen to classical music and it all sounds like classical music to us, but like
it was revolutionary.
There are ones where people were like setting the theater on fire afterwards. Yeah. Like, what?
The devil's me. How dare you do those chord changes? Yeah. Those are the devil's chords. Don't put those two together.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny. I talked to Tao first thing this morning, and I quoted the same thing I want to quote to you right now. Rush, fucking Geddy Lee, saying, was it in Tom Sawyer? All this machinery making my music can still be open-hearted.
Yeah.
I always loved that line. You know, it's like, and that was at a time when, you know, we look back on it now and it's so analog to us. Right. You know, but.
Right, right. No, but that was like, if you're using synthesizers, it was like, this is electronic music.
Yeah.
Now, you know?
But I mean, like Pink Floyd, like you don't really, unless you've, you know, that what's that one Obscured by Clouds?
Yeah,
heard that record.
Oh, great.
Jesus Christ,
great record, man. It's amazing.
That
yeah.
synthesizer work was so weird.
Yeah, Rick was brilliant, man.
Oh, it's, my god.
So these past 2 years I've been out with Roger Waters.
Oh, no way.
And doing keyboards and guitars on that, and the keyboard players I've been working for, the one guy, John Karen's been in the band since the 80s. You know, he was part of Pink Floyd in the 80s.
Wow.
And he's just such a wealth of knowledge. I've learned so much. You know, and he's, yeah. And John is really great about being like, oh yeah, well they did this on this song. And like, he's just, he knows
the back.
Everything yeah. they did in the studio, wow. and we recreate it live with different pedals and
do
stuff.
Do these dudes write? Do you ever get the sense that they're going to put a book out sometime? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Totally, yeah. There's definitely, yeah. You know, there's guys that have mentioned it, and also, like, I know guys that absolutely should if they're not planning
yeah,
on it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I love that sort of thing, man. There's so many touring musicians, man. I mean, it's an old thing. Mm-hmm. Right, I mean that, the minstrel from
yeah.
like, you know, far back into those traveling, you know, troubadours.
Yeah,
and, you know,
I was just talking, my girlfriend's a drummer, and we were just talking about this the other day about how musicians, as a byproduct of your vocation, you travel and especially back in the day, you became well rounded. And you became yeah. knowledgeable and worldly and gained perspective and all these things that you couldn't do yeah. if you were sedentary, you know.
To, in my mind, this is a dumbass theory as well. The only reason there's Indian food in Memphis, Tennessee is because musicians traveled and were like, man, Indian food's good, man. And
yeah.
they're like, you should open up an Indian restaurant yeah. here because you're an Indian guy. You know, like that type of thing. And I just feel like they are the ones who bring back the spices.
Yeah.
And they bring back the, like, oh, no, yeah. man, I saw this crazy thing. You know, Japanese guys are doing this and, you know, the so-and-so's doing that. Like, I just feel like that's the way that cool yeah. shit spreads around is by
musicians. Yeah, they're kind of the trailblazers, you know, and yeah. a lot of that. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're in the mix with them and keeping support. I can't believe you. I've known you very little, but I didn't realize you were a Stevie Wonder's guy. Like,
that's yeah, it's been a while. I've been super lucky to just kind of really maintain a relationship with really top artists, which has been
yeah
a blessing, blessing.
And it's got to be a testament to what kind of person you are to work with. You know what I mean? Like, you just can't be an asshole and...
Yeah, you can't be an
and
asshole.
And keep doing it,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
maybe once.
But, yeah, yeah, you're allowed to be... It's the road. You're allowed to be frustrated.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But in general, the assholes don't last. And then you end up on the tours where you're like, oh, fuck, this is where all the assholes ended up.
this is the asshole graveyard
yeah.
where they go to die. Oh, God. Well, thank you for doing this. I know it's late. We've all had like these long days, man.
Yeah.
But this is a great chat for me, and I'm glad I got the opportunity.
No, thanks for having me. That's great, man. Yeah, awesome.